With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi there and welcome to the Stock Club podcast. I'm James, and with me this week is my Wall Street co-founder and chief investor, Emmett Savage, and our head analyst, Rory Caron. In this episode, we're talking about the reasons why the stock market doesn't reflect economic realities in the US at the minute, Nikola Motors, the $25 billion electric car company with no revenue, and the reasons why bankrupt companies like Hertz are jumping more than 800%. So guys, recently we've received a lot of questions in from listeners asking us about the current state of the market. Rory, I think you've said before that the stock market likes certainty, but I think it's fair to say that this year has been anything but certain. We've seen a global lockdown due to the COVID-19 pandemic, an unemployment rate of as much as 16% reported in the US in May, not to mention widespread civil unrest over the past few weeks across dozens of US cities, and the ever-looming threat of a second wave of coronavirus infections. Despite all of this uncertainty, the Nasdaq hit all-time highs this week, crossing the 10,000 point mark for the first time ever, while both the Dow Jones and S&P 500 aren't far off their all-time highs either. Rory, how do we explain this massive discrepancy between the trajectory of the stock market over the last few weeks and the realities on the ground for many people in the US?
Yeah, well, look, you said it, you know, you think about what's actually going on at the moment in the United States, or I mean, around the world, but particularly in the United States. You know, nearly at one point you had 40 million people were losing their jobs in the space of just a couple of weeks. Hundreds of thousands of small businesses have to shut. Many of them will probably never reopen. And now, if you turn on the news in any country in the world, you're seeing mass public protests in the United States over the killing of George Floyd, with, you know, even some bad actors hijacking those for looting businesses. So it's, I can understand why it's difficult for people to understand how the market is where it's at with all this going on. Yeah. And of course, you know, we still don't have a vaccine. COVID-19 is not over yet. There's could well be a second wave. In fact, there probably will be in some states in the US, or they're already seeing signs of them. And I think, yeah, you know, I read a tweet where someone said either the stock market was undervalued before COVID-19 or it's overvalued now. And I think that's a lot of the time how people think about these things, but it's just, that's not really how the stock market actually works. The stock market is all about sentiment. It's about how positive or negative people are feeling about the future. I mean, that's in the short term, which is what we're definitely dealing with at the moment. You know, in the long term, companies rise based on performance and based on earnings. But in the short term, the market fluctuates, sometimes quite violently, based on people's just perceptions of where they're going to be in the next couple of months. You know, in October 1987, when the stock market dropped 50%, those companies didn't become 50% less valuable in terms of like what they were actually, the companies themselves. It was the sentiment surrounding the value of those companies that fell. And, you know, you have to look at the positives as well. You know, you think about the most highly weighted stocks in the S&P 500 at the moment. It's your Amazons, it's your Microsofts, your Googles, your Facebooks. All these companies are probably going to benefit from this crisis over the long run. So why shouldn't they be hitting all-time highs, and why shouldn't they be driving the index higher? So, and you know, there's short-term signs of a faster recovery. You know, even just last week, they saw record numbers of job gains in the US, 2.5 million new jobs created in the space of a week. Airlines are looking like they're going to open up faster again. So you're balancing what is kind of the cautiousness of a second wave, long-term unemployment, a recession, with the positives that are out there. And at the same time, you kind of think like an awful lot of people have more money in their pocket today than they did 3 months ago. Yeah. You know, that's just a fact of life. Lots of people, their jobs were pretty much unaffected by this. They went home, they worked from home. They haven't been able to spend as much because the usual places that you spend money are closed to them. And there was stimulus checks sent out to people in the mail. So an awful lot of people have more money than they had beforehand. And some people are putting that into the market. I think we're going to talk about the Robinhood trading a bit further on in the podcast, but There's so many different factors affecting the market right now. You can't simply look at it as a, well, the stock market should be lower today than it was 3 months ago because we've been through all this.
How important do you think, Rory, it was that the recent sell-off we experienced was an event-driven sell-off rather than, you know, if you take 2008, 2009 as an example, that was kind of a systematic failure rather than this big, massive event which shut the world down. Is the kind of the thing that drives a sell-off important in how it recovers?
Well, 100%. Of course it is. That is the major difference between this sell-off and what we saw in 2008, which was, as you said, a complete breakdown of the systems that were supposed to be in place to protect people from the next Great Depression. And, you know, that's why, I mean, I was speaking to a webinar the other day and people were asking all sorts of questions about a recession. And you've got to remember, like, a lot of the fear revolving around recessions is that the last one we experienced was so awful. It was like one of the, like, the worst in history, and it took so long for us to recover from it. And it's probably the thing that most young investors, the first thing that comes into their head when they think about a recession is that, you know, the great financial crisis of 2008. Whereas most recessions are far milder than that, are far shorter than that. They happen on average about once every five to 10 years, and they last roughly around 18 months. So, you know, recessions aren't necessarily something to be totally freaked out about. For young investors in particular, it's a good opportunity to buy stocks at a low rather than at all-time highs, which we've seen consistent new all-time highs be set over the past 10 years.
Yeah, absolutely. One of our listeners, Killian, wrote in after the last podcast and asked, do we think that the market might be in a coronavirus bubble? So what he was wondering, I suppose, was boy, but it's success of kind of stocks that benefited from the lockdown, like Amazon and Shopify, those e-commerce stocks. Do you think that we're still in a kind of a bubble riding out of the recent sell-off?
Yeah, I think so. If a vaccine arrived on our doorsteps tomorrow, I think a lot of the businesses that have benefited from coronavirus will fall back, but not back to where they were, because their businesses have fundamentally improved and changed the way we all behave. There are people who today have at long last realized that shopping via Amazon exclusively is way easier. There are people who realize taking the drive to work 5 days a week doesn't make sense. And the companies themselves have realized it. So things will revert for sure to a point. So I don't think it's a bubble or a coronavirus bubble per se, but I do think that when eventually normality, whatever that is, returns, it won't be the way things were in middle week of January 2020.
Absolutely.
Often when I tell my partner about a stock getting a big increase over the course of a few weeks, she'll say something like, it looks like a bubble. Like, you can't see a bubble. That's why it's called a bubble. If it looks like so, yeah, that's the whole point of a bubble. But yeah, I agree. Like, you know, we don't know. And also there was a great quote. Someone quoted George Soros yesterday, who said that whenever he sees a bubble, he rushes in. You know, sometimes you have to get on board with these things.
Yeah, that's true, if that's the way the market's going. Moving down to kind of individual companies then. So Tesla stock closed at an all-time high this week thanks to reports of increased demand for the Model 3 car in China. The success of Tesla, though, recently has been kind of overshadowed by the new kid on the block, Nikola Motors. Claiming the first name of the famous inventor, Nikola began trading on the Nasdaq on June 4th after a reverse merger with Vector IQ, and has since more than doubled in value. It's currently valued at around the same as Ford, despite having never produced a vehicle. Rory, I know you've been kind of keeping a close eye on Nikola recently. What's your thoughts on this company?
My first thought is I wish he had a middle name. Because, you know, name anything after this guy and people just go crazy. As you said, this is a company. It went public on June 4th, a reverse merger, similar to what we saw with Virgin Galactic and DraftKings. It's a company that specializes in battery electric and hydrogen electric trucks for the most part. That's their kind of... their niche in the market. They're going after the kind of the big semis that you see driving across the American highways. And yeah, the shares more than doubled on Monday, which at one point Meta was worth more than Ford. Ford, by the way, had a revenue of about $150 billion last year. Nikola has revenue of zero. dollars. Now, like, I mean, I think we're all well past the point of comparing companies like Tesla to the kind of more old school players like Ford and General Motors. I think we're kind of, we've gotten to the point of realizing that, yes, they do have something a little bit different to offer, and that, you know, they can expand into more of a technology space than simply being an automotive play. But this jump in share price is quite, it does seem quite manic, and it was largely down to an announcement by the company that they're going to start taking reservation orders for their Badger truck, which is kind of a direct competitor to Tesla Cybertruck.
It's a pretty cool looking truck.
Yeah, it's definitely on the more conservative design side than the Cybertruck. And they claim that they have about $10 billion in pre-order revenue. But of course, we know that is pretty much meaningless. That's very much dependent on whether they can actually get these cars built, which we don't know. And it's just part of a kind of a larger buy-in to anything to do with kind of green energy. There's a couple of hydrogen fuel cell makers like Plug Power and Bloom Energy are also seeing some big stock pops at the moment as investors rush into greener fuel alternatives. So look, it's definitely a manic symbol in the market right now that a company with zero revenue is being valued at $33 billion. And I would avoid anyone listening to avoid it.
Yeah. I mean, I'd go so far, I'm going to make a bold claim, and that is that I think the Nikola trucks are the WeWork of transportation. I think it's phony.
Wow, and, that's a big statement.
Yeah, and I'm going to tell you why, and I, of course, you know, it may prove that I'm absolutely wrong, but for a Tesla Semi, you need to drop a $20,000 deposit, whereas with a Nikola, it's zero. So that means a lot of pre-orders will come in just to hold your place in line. So apparently Anheuser-Busch has reserved up to 800 trucks. And even in an interview I was listening to recently, the founding CEO, Trevor Milton, said that very few people can out Elon Musk, but I'm one of them, he said.
Okay. And, alarm bells ringing there.
That's bold. And then he was brought out onto stage by Anheuser's Clydesdale horses for an unveil. And he said in an interview that they're burning $200 million a month, which sounds preposterously low. I think he got his numbers wrong on that. You know, I think they've in their prospectus, they've spent something like $500 to $800 million so far. So I don't believe they've 2 million a month burn rate. Now, if we forgive the guy and just say that was just a numerical slip up, I still think that this is WeWorkish. Now, I don't doubt that we will see these trucks on the road eventually, as of course we saw WeWork offices appear everywhere. But I just think its valuation is crazy.
I think as well, we've got to have a bit more skepticism about these reverse merger deals that are coming out. They're getting a lot more popular at the moment, and it does kind of leave investors open to a bit of a, hold on, there's a new company and it's going up really fast. Maybe I should get into it. You know, it doesn't give you the same kind of long drawn out prospectus inquiry that you get from an IPO. Not saying that that's the perfect way of doing things either, but maybe there's somewhere there's a kind of middle ground between those two, because just to have a company suddenly appear on the stock market with, you know, and people are kind of shocked. They're like, oh, I didn't even know DraftKings was a public company, because it happened so quickly. And I think, you know, maybe you just need to kind of take a step back with those things and be like, right, what's going on here? Why is this company suddenly floating their shares like this?
That was a question I actually wanted to ask, Gori. Do you think this kind of reverse merger, it's becoming the preferred option of flotation for these kind of speculative companies? I'm thinking of Virgin Galactic as well, which, you know, aren't making a lot of revenue, but suddenly float on the market and suddenly get these huge valuations.
Well, I mean, I don't have any kind of, moral viewpoint against them. If, you know, everyone should be aware of what they're buying when they're buying it, regardless of how a company went to market on it. And IPOs are, you know, are complete sales cycles, as we've discussed many times. You know, that's an entire boiler room of people telling you to buy a stock for months on end before you find that big day when it finally appears on the stock market. So, you know, it all comes down to personal investors and being like, don't rush in to buy something just because it's new, just because it's flashy. Do your due diligence. Make sure you understand the business, and again, always make sure you're going to buy it with the view of holding it for an awful long time. We tell people to avoid stocks when they recently IPO because we think there's an awful lot of hype floating around them for a couple of months after that. We've got a kind of personal a personal limit on when we add companies to the stock, which is kind of two quarters essentially.
Yeah.
I think that's a good time to see whether a business is going to, how a business is going to kind of exist within the confines of the public markets. And, you know, you may end up missing out on a couple of percentage points by waiting that extra time. But in the long run, it's, you know, if you're investing in a company hoping that it's going to be a massive big winner for you, a couple of percentage points is not going to make a huge difference.
Absolutely.
Couldn't agree
more. So moving on then, we've already spoken about how the market isn't exactly reflecting economic reality at the minute. But another seemingly illogical thing we've seen is the share price of some struggling companies rally as investors flood in. The best example of this is probably Hertz, which saw its stock lose more than 95% of its value between February and March after the company filed for bankruptcy protection. However, since those lows at the end of May, Hertz stock has jumped more than 880% at one point. Rory, what do you think is going on here with Hertz?
Well, yeah, look, it's not just Hertz. It's, you know, bizarrely, and I can't believe I'm saying the sentence, but the best performing stocks over the last couple of weeks have been companies that have either filed for or have suggested they're filing for bankruptcy. Hertz is the most well-known example. You know, this is a company that has $19 billion in debt and holds about 700,000 vehicles that at the moment it can't use. And yet the stock has popped several times over the past couple of days. At one point, I think it was up something like 1,000% from its lows.
Wow.
And I mean, like, look, we've already talked about the creeping good news that's making everyone a bit optimistic. You know, the jobs report, the airlines coming back. Hertz is obviously very much tied to airlines. And you know, there was some speculation that, you know, $15 billion of the company's debt is tied to their fleet, which maybe they'll be able to get more cash from it at a liquidation. But like, if you understand anything about Chapter 11 bankruptcy, you understand this is awful for shareholders nearly every which way it comes. In Chapter 11, shareholders are at the very, very bottom of the ladder when it comes to getting your money in a liquidation scenario. They have to pay back all the secured debt, all the non-secured debt, before they can give anything back to the common shareholder. And I think there's an awful lot of misinformation out there. Things like, you know, people saying, oh, well, General Motors went bankrupt back in 2009 and now they're a $42 billion company. And it's true. A small handful of bankrupt companies maintain some level of equity value for investors, but the majority of them ultimately go to zero and the stock has to be delisted and it has to go back onto the market at a time in the future under a different ticker or perhaps under the same ticker. But the original equity holders get zero. There's no, you're not going to get money back after a stock's delisted like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, and you look at someone like Carl Icahn, who's been probably Hertz's biggest champion over the years, was the company's largest shareholder. He sold every single one of his shares at 72 cents, booking a $1.5 billion loss. And now the stock's trading at $4. It's just, and the New York Stock Exchange has just sent them a letter saying you're going to be delisted. So, you know, there's insane mania going on in the market right now. A lot of it's being contributed to this kind of Robinhood shareholder that's going in making very speculative bets. I even saw a big piece in CNBC the other day, which was praising a bunch of these anecdotal cases of people who'd made, you know, 24x returns in a week by buying puts on bankrupt companies. And you have to be very careful. That's promoting a very bad form of investing. It's heavily weighted in survivorship bias. You're not going to get interviews with, you know, Alan who lost his entire savings by betting on something. It's only the people who are going to have done well, who've made serious amounts of money, that are going to be on CNBC or be interviewed by CNBC to talk about how great they've done. So, you know, and in times of volatility like this, there's plenty of ways to make money, plenty of ways to make a fast buck when stocks are shooting up and down at these kind of levels. But it's not investing. It's casino gambling. Just as long as, so if you're going to do it, but just be aware that you're rolling a dice and far more people lose than win.
Absolutely. So then a company that should have benefited from the recent lockdown orders is Stitch Fix. However, sales of the clothing subscription service actually fell 9% in the last quarter due to supply chain issues. The company also recently laid off 1,400 workers, representing almost 20% of its workforce in an effort to reduce costs. Stitch Fix is a selection in the My Wall Street shortlist. What's your view on the company as of late?
Yeah, well, James, as I just remind our listeners what Stitch Fix actually does, the company uses sophisticated algorithms and human stylists to choose which items to send you in a regular shipment, which they call a fix. And it's based on input from the client and their past purchasing behavior. But in simple terms, Stitch Fix sends you a box of clothes and you keep the bits you want and send back what you don't want. And as you rightfully said, at the start of this week, they reported quarterly sales decreased 9% year over year, which is really unimpressive when you consider that we're, you know, all at home in our panic rooms, away from the nasty bugs and germs, with no new threads and no new chance of getting any new threads. And like, who doesn't want to look stylish on the couch? So on the whole, you know, I was kind of taken aback that in a world that suddenly went looking for, you know, things to buy via the web, you know, that Stitch Fix didn't enjoy that as a benefit to their business. The number of active clients increased by 9% in the quarter, and operating losses were $46 million compared to $4.6 million in the year ago period. So their operating losses went up tenfold. And in a letter to shareholders, Katrina Lake and the company, the founder Katrina Lake, has said that the fulfillment constraints hampered sales throughout the quarter, you know, and that they believe they would have grown revenue year over year. So that might imply that things are going to look better for their fiscal Q4, where they expect to return to growth. And as you said, they're laying off 1,400 people, actually 1,400 stylists in California.
Okay.
And hiring stylists in lower cost markets. And I just presume a stylist in California has a higher salary than, you know, in a cheaper market. So they're looking to, but when I looked at their strategy, when I look at Stitch Fix now, they're saying they're going to bolster sales by letting anyone, regardless of whether they get fixes or not, shop as they would on a traditional e-commerce site. And they said they test launched this in February, and it enables clients to buy items a la carte separately from fixes through a service that they call Direct Buy. So this innovation sounds really familiar. It's called shopping on the internet.
Online shopping.
You know, online shopping, exactly. So I was a little bit unimpressed at that because, you know, their thing is they send you a box of gear, as you call clothing over here in Dublin. They send you a box of clothing every at frequencies. I think it's once a month, and you keep the pieces you like. But now all of a sudden, it's the place you go to buy a shirt when you need a shirt. And I don't like that. I think the fundamentals of this business have kind of deteriorated, and yet the stock is high flying, to our listeners' question about a coronavirus bubble, perhaps. But I don't like it. And I'm unimpressed. And I don't think that Stitch Fix said anything in its most recent call that made me feel, oh, now we're looking at a bargain. Now, sure, growth might resume. And of course, there were reasons. There's always reasons. But I thought this was their golden moment to speak to those people who are stuck at home, but still wanted to fashion themselves up a bit.
Cool. So before we move on to Jargon Busters then, I just want to take a quick look at some of the other things happening in My Wall Street at the moment. So far this month, we've already published June's Stock of the Month report and the Stock of the Month podcast. You can listen to both of these in the My Wall Street app right now, exclusive for subscribers. This month's Stock of the Month pick is already up close to 10% in less than 2 weeks, contributing to our performance that has seen our Stock of the Month selections return an average of more than 92% over the past 3.5 years. Of course, there are plenty of other great things to check out in My Wall Street at the moment too, including our daily articles and our news updates from the market. If you're not already a member of My Wall Street, you can sign up now and get a free trial where you can access all of this stuff by just clicking on the link in the notes for today's show. Jargon Busters, Rory, I think I'm going to come to you first. This question: when considering an investment, do you ever take the differing tax rates between ETFs and share purchases into consideration, or do you just focus on the investment itself? That came in from John through Twitter.
I'm going to go out on a limb here and presume that John is from Ireland.
I think so, yep.
Because in most countries, there is no difference between ETFs and stocks. Whereas in Ireland, the rules regarding ETFs are about as long as a Leonard Cohen song. It's incredibly convoluted and very hard to understand. Even like I have a QFA, I still have trouble getting my head around the tax implications of ETF ownership in Ireland. So yeah, just to put a disclaimer on that this is a very Irish unique problem. Yeah, it is something you should definitely consider. Of course, the taxes you're going to pay on your capital gains and on your dividends do make a big difference when it comes to the time when you're going to sell. And in Ireland, there's even more different rules where you're forced to pay it every 8 years, which, again, sorry to all our American listeners that you have to listen to this nonsense, but this is the kind of thing we have to deal with here. I'm not going to dig too deep into it in terms of getting its specifics, but yeah, you do need to take it into consideration. And, at the very least, if you're worried about it, consult a professional to find out what the best option for you is. Because a lot of the times, ETFs are domiciled in different countries, and each of those has different tax implications as well. So yeah, it's definitely something to consider, definitely something to look into. And typically, if you can find one with the least tax liabilities, that's usually the one to go for.
Okay, cool. Helpful. Thanks, Rory. Evan, I'm going to throw this next one over to you, and it comes from Dave through email. He asks, how much cash should you typically keep in reserve in your portfolio account? Is 10% the standard amount?
When I look at the average cash that I've held in my account for my online account for 22 years, from when I started with Daytech way back when in 98, I've only ever been 5% in cash. Now, I'm not saying that's right or wrong, but my mentality at a personal level is, well, if I'm sending money over, it's there to invest, and I'm keeping a small amount back if things drop. So 10% sounds good, sounds right to me. I certainly doesn't strike me as the incorrect answer. There is no absolutely correct answer. I read an interview several years ago with a guy who had an unbelievable and outlandish compounded annual growth rate. It was like 24%, and he was always 20% in cash, which was like, it was akin to magic. I mean, it was that good. So really, there's no right or wrong answer. But the way I look at it is that, if you have 5 or 10% cash in your portfolio, it's nice to have line of sight to cash outside of your portfolio should you need it. So if there was the greatest of sell-offs ever known to humankind next week, 5% cash is going to feel like you just don't have enough. So if you're in that fortunate part of the world where you can actually see availability of cash outside of your folio that you can run to if you need it, well, that's kind of good too. But I think 10% sounds absolutely fine. And adding cash regularly is the key to successful investing. And once Dave is adding cash to the stocks he most prefers on a frequent basis, and perhaps keeping 10% banked on the side in cash all the time, I think that's a very mature and appropriate way to approach building your portfolio.
Absolutely. It's an interesting question, because I think people often forget that, not to sound too much like Warren Buffett here, but cash is a bad investment.
Oh, yeah. I'm just very thankful, just because I couldn't, I never really had the great patience to wait for this stock I really like to fall. I'd buy it because also my memory, it's like, I like this business now. I know why I like it now. I'm going to buy it now. And, then I can forget about it. And then someday if I see it 20% in the red, well, then I have a new decision. Do I buy more or do I just leave it? So there's something about, like, you take an action when you've got the impetus and you've got the aggregated knowledge. And I think that that's the best way to go about it.
Absolutely. So that was Jargon Busters. If you have any questions you'd like to send in for next time's Jargon Busters, make sure to get in touch with us. You can email us at pod@mywallstreet.com or just shoot us a message on Twitter. Let's move on to the elevator pitches now. So considering that we're now in June and almost halfway through the year, believe it or not, I thought we'd revisit some of the big predictions both of you guys made for 2020 back in December and see how they're getting on. Rory, I'm going to come to you first. I kind of feel a bit unfair maybe bringing this up now. So you predicted that beyond Beyond Meat stock would be cut in half this year. The time you made that prediction, Beyond was trading about $75 a share. And it's just recently had a bit of a spike where it's now hovering around $155 a share. Do you want to comment on that, or will we just move on quickly?
You're loving this, aren't you? I'm going to preface this by saying that when I made that prediction, that was coming off a previous prediction that the stock was going to be cut in half, which it was. Yeah. And then I said it was going to be cut in half again. So it's only brought kind of back to where I originally was talking about it. And so far, 6 months in, my prediction's not working out. Yeah. I will say that, you know, like, the thing about Beyond is, and this is what's kind of annoying, is that I actually quite like the company. I think they're a really good company. I think they've got a really good brand. I think they were, you know, quick off the mark when this whole thing started gaining traction, and they've done very well. They've obviously penetrated an awful lot of markets with their partnerships with the various quick service restaurants. And the fact that the quick service restaurants are using their branding is very positive as well. That shows that it's a really strong brand. And look, there's other things that have been going well for them. They've entered China with a brand new partnership deal just announced a couple of weeks ago. They've kicked off with KFC. They've got a new partnership with Starbucks. So there's an awful lot of positive news that you would expect to drive a stock up in value. But I mean, I still look at this company and go, it can't be worth $10 billion. It just can't be. It's like, if you were to look at any other packaged food company in the world, the likes of Tyson, Conagra, Kellogg's, those kind of businesses, they're generating, you know, billions and billions of dollars every year and are getting absolutely like nowhere near the kind of multiples that Beyond Meat is getting. And I understand that Beyond Meat is a smaller company and those companies are old juggernauts without the same growth potential. But all those companies are getting into this space and are going to release their own versions of Beyond Meat products, possibly even better versions of the Beyond Meat product. They're going to have much more marketing spend, much more promotional spend. They've got the relationship with distributors, and I think people are totally underestimating the competitive environment that Beyond Meat is going to find itself in within a year or two. And I also think they're going to see lagging sales due to this coronavirus panic as well. So I've been wrong so far. I could be wrong again, but my view on the business, this is a great business, but it's really overvalued.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's that kind of idea that a lot of people are on board with this kind of meatless revolution, for want of a better term. And Beyond Meat seems to a lot of people be the only avenue to invest in it, whereas obviously it's going to become a much wider field as time progresses.
Yeah, I mean, look, I do not think Beyond Meat their stock would be successful if there was four or five plant-based meat companies that were on the public markets today. It's because it's the only name out there at the moment that I think it sees such massive price appreciation. The stock is trading at the moment at something like 25 times price to sales. Like, you look at any other packaged foods company, they barely get 1 times price to sales.
Okay. So I promise I won't bring it up again until December. Emmett, over to your prediction. So you predicted that 2020 would be a catastrophic year for big retail brands. I don't know if that was a prediction of the coronavirus lockdown or not, but I can see you dusting your shoulders off there.
Yeah, I mean, I don't revel in misery, but 25,000 stores are predicted to close in 2020. And it really is as a result of the coronavirus accelerating an upheaval of the whole industry. So, you know, we may just a month or so ago, JCPenney filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection, closing 242 stores. You know, big brands, big names that we know are shuttering, and it's regrettable, it's horrible, it's actually very sad. There's a loss of jobs and focal points for communities. But CNBC ran a headline story this morning that, you know, 25,000 stores are predicted to close, you know, in the 12 months. So that's huge. And I think, therefore, I can claim a victory on that call.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you made a good point there as well, in that, you know, the coronavirus and the subsequent lockdowns just kind of quickened the trajectory of the direction this was already going in.
Oh, it did, absolutely. Everyone listening knows they've augmented the way they go about living their life, and that change has come through digitalization through the web enablement of purchases, and you know, going into a shop is something that I think, or into a big store, something most of us, if we've done it since the coronavirus outbreak, have felt somewhat nervous about. You know, the collective intelligence is that you're less likely to contract the illness if you're outdoors. When you go inside an enclosed space with others, you know, you've reason to be fearful, and that's still there. As Rory said earlier on, coronavirus is not over, and unfortunately for these retailers, and I think most especially, I feel very sorry for the mom and pop stores. Like, I genuinely look at businesses that are one-off units or a couple of multiples, and I see them closed, and I know that behind that is an entrepreneur,
yeah,
a woman,
absolutely,
or a man or a couple who've put their heart and soul into this, and it's now kind of, it's gathering dust. I think it's terrible. And a lot of us are going to keep our habits now on digital, and then eventually we'll pass. But unfortunately, yeah, it's come to pass.
Absolutely.
I saw a data point that percentage of people online shopping, or the percentage of shopping that's done online, has increased in the last 3 months more than it had done in the previous 14 years.
Wow.
Which is just unbelievable when you think about that move from brick and mortar to digital. And you know, those customers aren't going away. They're going to stay digital. Once you're up and running, it's very hard to stop.
Absolutely. So that's it from this week's Stock Club. Don't forget about all the great new stuff I've mentioned in My Wall Street at the moment. And if there's anything you do want us to explain or discuss on the next episode of Stock Club, make sure to get in touch. You can catch us on Twitter, that's at My Wall Street HQ, or email us at pod@mywallstreet.com. That's pod@mywallstreet.com. Don't forget to subscribe to Stock Club too. And if you're enjoying the podcast, please leave a review for us on whatever platform you listen to us on. From all of us here today, we'll talk to you in 2 weeks. Happy investing.